start off this evening talking about a fire that broke out earlier in January, on the 14th of January, at a Rohingya refugee camp in Bangladesh's southern district of Cox's Bazar, burning down at least 400 makeshift homes, according to official sources. And at that stage, the victims were shifted to another place where they were provided with emergency food and other services. And at that stage as well, no deaths were reported. However, there were some reports of refugees being slightly injured. And the initial report said that there were investigations underway to determine the cause of the fire. Unverified sources said that more than 500 tents were damaged and more than 3,500 people had actually become homeless. Now, as you know, on the show repeatedly, we try to not look at events on their own, but, you know, it's not just the fire that we're talking about, but we're looking at it in its wider context. We're talking about principles, we're talking about issues, and we're talking about being consistent. So this evening we talk about the fire, the effects of the fire, but always tracing it back to where did this start, what's the root cause, how do we address the root cause, and also some other wider updates regarding the Rohingya issue. From Protect the Rohingya, Advocate Shabnam Mayat on the line with us. Shabnam, shukran for your time once again. Assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Walaikum salam. Thank you very much for having me on the show. And I learned something new because we always hear about guerrilla art and guerrilla theatre, but never guerrilla gardening. So I look forward to hearing about that.
Yes, a beautiful manifestation of that on our highways and byways at the moment. To something, though, Shabnam, that is heartbreaking, a heartbreaking start to 2021, and that is this fire out in Cox's Bazar. I understand, if I'm pronouncing correctly, the part of Cox's Bazar that was affected here in this fire, area called Nayapara. Tell us, what do we know about this fire?
Okay, so actually it's one in a series of three fires that have happened over the period of the last week. On the 14th, there was one at Nayapara. On the 18th, one at Camp 16. And on the 23rd, one at Camp 7. As you correctly said, the one the one that was the worst was the first one. Around 3,500 were left homeless, around 150 shops, 550 shelters. And, you know, one wonders when we say minor injuries with the Rohingya, because a lot of people, you know, took shots as they left Bangladesh and Myanmar. And by that, I mean bullet wounds, and kept walking. So with the Rohingya, one never knows what minor means, right? In the second one, learning centers were burnt down, more homes, more shops, and, you know, conspiracy theories abound because it's just been this week and people are trying to figure out what exactly is going on, and people are pointing to agent provocateurs. Some are saying that this is, you know, an underhanded trick by the government to scare people into agreeing to the bus and char move. There's been nothing solid at this stage, and I suppose we shouldn't be listening to conspiracy theories, but it's already been three fires in a week, and it's really scary because you must remember, and we've all seen images before about how the camps are built. They're technically a fire hazard. Everyone is on top of one another. It's a million people. And if one shelter catches fire, it's just a matter of time until the 100 shelters around that catch fire as well. Each shelter housing around 10 to 12 people.
And I mean, just to expand on that point, the fire hazard that exists there, I mean, to draw a South African parallel, would it assist our understanding to say that, you know, the way a fire would spread in a refugee camp, a crowded camp like that, would be very akin to an informal settlement in South Africa? And we've just had, I think, just another instance of that yesterday.
I think probably much faster, because you must remember that the camps, the shelters are held up, they're just bamboo and canvas, right? So much faster, because there's not a lot of tin that we're talking about, and bamboo is highly, you know, those sticks catch on fire really quickly, and canvas, of course, as well. So it's much faster. And the problem is that, you know, to leave the area where you are, because everything is so closely packed that to get out of the way of the fire is also very difficult and quite a hazard. And it's brilliant, you know, that they've managed to, like, no one passed away and they managed to get everyone away from the area. But of course, people have so few belongings and so few valuable things. And all of that, of course, was destroyed, along with some UN offices, along with some informal schools. It's really terrible news.
What does this do, what we know in terms of how this is going to put extra pressure to deal with, you know, the housing needs as well as the other emergency needs? And, you know, is it simply a case of clearing out the rubble and you know, putting up something makeshift? Or is there something, you know, that could, in these difficult circumstances, at least, you know, assure some kind of safety from future disasters?
I'm not sure that the Bangladeshi government has, you know, the resources to put up proper housing and proper structures. And of course, unfortunately, because of the way the situation is and how the Bangladeshi government has not moved for an integration, allowing Rohingya, you know, to live in the country, to work in the country, to seek their own livelihood, they're totally dependent on handouts and aid. And this, of course, will add a lot more pressure. And that's why perhaps initially, you know, everyone was just saying there would be repatriation and they'd go back. But perhaps now the Bangladeshi government, instead of looking at building fences around the mega camp and putting up watchtowers and cameras, it's time to really talk integration, because repatriation, you know, has been spoken about. Nothing has materialized. In fact, you know, already 3,500 Rohingya have been moved to Basan Char, the island. Perhaps now is really time to speak about integration.
If, I mean, as you said, not to give wind to anything that's not verified, but at the same time, you know, one would be the living conditions. But if, you know, there are any kind of subversive elements or anybody, you know, trying to do something untoward, is there also a requirement, or is there a need for security, in a way, you know, general security for the inhabitants of these camps, and also to protect against anything untoward?
Okay, so as we know, right, most of the administrative staff, the collection of aid, camps have a heavy military presence, and military handle most of these things, along with the NGOs, but their military stops everywhere and checkpoints. And now that they're going to, you know, now that they've been fencing in the entire camp and putting up check towers, I don't think more surveillance and more militarization is necessary. Because I think that what they've done is, you know, not allowed Rohingya to leave to work. They're not integrating. They're not allowed into the school system. And that in itself is creating a hazard, in terms of people become frustrated when they're forced to live in this kind of situation. It's a situation that breeds desperation. And if it's already been, you know, 3 years, going on 4 years, why not just let them out and let them start living their lives, put those, you know, 500,000 kids in school and get them out of this limbo? That would seem the more realistic option, I think.
Mm-hmm. Reports, as we would understand, not only in terms of, you know, the Rohingya refugees, but refugees all across the world, the COVID pandemic has put a severe strain on the kind of aid that is going in. With an incident like this, or incidents like these exacerbating the situation, you know, are we seeing a major drop in the kind of assistance that's available?
There is, and out of safety issues, of course, NGOs are not operating the way they are with the same amount of workers. But also, if we think about what's happening to Rohingya in Myanmar, right, the large number, 600,000 Rohingya still in Myanmar, 130,000 of those still in those internment camps, you know, the internet blackout, the restriction of movement. And so when it comes to COVID, those are in the worst case scenario. They're even stuck, you know, between a conflict between the government and the Arakan Army, you know, so those, it's really problematic, and COVID has really made it worse for everyone. But of course, as you said correctly, much worse a situation for Rohingya. I mean, no one even knows half of the time what the Rohingya themselves in Myanmar that are still stuck there are going through.
Just in terms of practical routes here, I mean, there are initiatives from South Africa, grassroots mm-hmm. initiatives, you know, just to keep that aid going and, sustainable projects as well. What is available for South Africans, to your knowledge, to be able to assist, in sustainable projects as well as emergency relief, like, in response to something like this?
So Colors of Hope has a wonderful disaster relief effort running for relief for the fires specifically that just came up this week. And then your normal organizations, all of your big names, international names, like Lonely Orphans, like the relief, Islamic Relief organizations. So one just needs to do, a quick search. But if we want to support local, I think the ladies at Colors of Hope are, doing wonderful work, and their disaster relief option is available at the moment.
Let's move on from this immediate incident to issues of repatriation, issues of relocation. Mm-hmm. And after many years of rumors here about relocation to this Basin Chad, which is a island or not even formally defined island, but a mass of sediment that has defined an island 30 kilometers from the mainland of Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. After rumors that the refugees are going to be sent there over a period of time, we understand that this process has begun. Just explain this to us.
Okay, so over some time now, the past few years, Bangladesh has been speaking about this island of Basan Char, which raised from the ocean around 20 years ago. And they spent around $350 million to set up a settlement on Basan Char, but there's not been outside checks or inspections. There's not been UN inspections to say that it's actually safe for human habitation, because it is on a cyclone path. And even Bangladeshi fishermen who know those waters have elected not to live there. That having been said, there have been constant stops on the movement of Rohingya refugees to Basan Char because of this and because of, the uncertainty. But then when Rohingya refugees tried to leave and they were pushed back by Malaysia early last year, citing COVID concerns, the 300 of them were taken to Basan Char and left there. Subsequently, at the start of last December, 1,600 refugees were moved there, and then towards the end of December, another 1,800. The Foreign Minister, Momin, has called it something like a beautiful resort, but there's been constant issues. There's been harassment for the 300 who were forced to go there, when they were not taken in by Malaysia. They said some of them were not allowed to pray. When there was a go-and-see visit by other heads of camps, they were not allowed to speak to those who already stuck on Basan Char. And it's really interesting to me that if you have nothing to hide, why not let the international observers in? They're saying that everyone being moved there went voluntarily, but, people are citing concerns of force, of false promises. And at the end of the day, it's a three-hour trip via boat. People who get there have no promise that they'll be able to return to the mainland. And should anything happen to them there, how will they even know about it? The Asia head of Human Rights Watch has called it the Rohingya Alcatraz, of course, after the infamous prison island 2 kilometers offshore from the United States. And it's a really pathetic situation, because if you think about it, 1 million people who were, victims of genocide, forced to leave their homes, shouldn't the main focus then be on them having a safe, protected, dignified return home, as opposed to putting them on this island that they know nothing about?
As far as what is available on the island, one is, structures that are put up, and are those, how do those compare to the current conditions, or perhaps that should not be a benchmark, it should be, humane conditions altogether. But beyond that, what kind of infrastructure, fixed infrastructure in terms of, medical infrastructure, electricity, water, telecommunications are available on this island?
Well, they say they're barrack-style buildings that have been built. There's fishing and farming facilities, not 100% sure around the electricity situation. But the point is that Rohingya, they were unhappy. Women put out photos last year with the sexual harassment concerns. Refugees who are on the island don't want to be there. So at the end of the day, like, you have to take it from those who are forced to be there. If they don't want to be there, why are we putting them there? And it's on a cyclone belt. So even if there are structures there, no one is certain that in the event of a cyclone, those structures will still stand.
And who fits the bill? I mean, there would be some repatriation costs and, you know, perhaps something to create a semblance of normality or a semblance of settlement on the island. Is, you know, this all going to fall upon Bangladesh? And is this a way of Myanmar completely washing itself of any responsibility, even for the minor costs that might be incurred related to this island?
So this has been a Bangladeshi payment, you know, and we've not heard anything about Myanmar offering to pay any costs. The only thing we've heard this week about Myanmar is, you know, about the tripartite meeting where China, Bangladesh and Myanmar are supposedly in a meeting, and the foreign minister or the foreign secretary of Bangladesh is cautiously optimistic about repatriation starting this year. But with China as a mediator for this meeting, I don't know how hopeful that is, considering that, you know, they're attempting to exterminate an entire Uyghur minority in their country. So the situation is looking bleak at the moment, and actually, Fortify Rights is a very well-known organization. One of their people put out a statement saying that repatriation at this time is closer to refoulement. And we all know that, you know, in international law, the law of non-refoulement basically says that you cannot take someone and force them back to a place where they're being persecuted. And so the situation is, you know, terrible at best. They're hoping that now the Biden government will have an interagency review to determine if Myanmar is committing genocide. The case still continues with a whole lot of technicalities being brought up by Myanmar at the ICJ. But I think the aim is not to push for a Baisenchar move. The aim should always be looking at getting the Rohingya back home, because that's what they want.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this review by the Biden administration. Just put it in the picture there. What was the role of the Trump administration and previous administrations? And does this represent a shift or in any way?
Well, in the past, you know, certain generals were put on the list in terms of assets freezing and not being allowed to travel to the U.S. But countries have not put out the word genocide, labeling what's happening, and they should. And perhaps the Biden administration will do that differently, but we'll all have to wait and see what comes out of this interagency review. Of course, once you say that it is genocide, it becomes the problem of every country in the world, and then it becomes a responsibility of every country in the world that has signed the Genocide Convention. And perhaps one of the reasons why countries are afraid to say genocide is because they don't want those responsibilities.
The final one I want to look at this evening, Shabnam, relates to communication within the camp. So I think an important issue that was previously raised is education, and we did that in one of our previous chats, the importance of, you know, not losing a generation, and there's a lot of focus on that at the moment, particularly in the wake of these fires, as you mentioned, that yet again destroyed the little educational infrastructure that's available to these refugees. I want to talk about communication. There's an internet ban in the camps. There are research, as I understand, that has been done that shows that in this dearth of information, a lot of the refugees depend heavily on getting any kind of information, updates, news from radio. What is the accessibility to this medium? Does it meet the needs of the Rohingya refugees? And is there anything, you know, organic that's being offered by the refugees themselves, perhaps some initiatives from their side looking at the needs that face them?
Well, I think what we can all understand is that, you know, in this day and age, we're highly dependent on the internet. And with an internet ban, or only 2G available, and very limited TV availability in the camps, radio is the most accessible and effective method for refugees to hear the news. And especially women who are often afraid to go out because of human trafficking concerns, etc., they can listen to the radio from a safe place. So around 2019, the Voice of America put up a daily Rohingya radio show. And then there's also another show on Radio NAF called Palanga Hota, which at the end of 2019 or around 2019 went on air. And they host panels about issues affecting refugee life. And then they broadcast those on the radio. And so there's also WhatsApp radio, you know, where people share news like that. But of course, with the internet ban, it's been a bit harder for that to happen. And so you correctly stated that radio is still very important for the refugees.
But your audit is that in the long term, obviously, radio is a versatile medium. And despite all the technological changes, many people all around the world still rely on it. But, you know, the most workable solution here is going to be internet-based.
I would think so. At this point, though, it's found that in the camps, more people trust what they're hearing on radio, and especially, you know, issues on illness or domestic violence. You know, when those issues are spoken about on radio, it's very helpful because women can listen to those from their safe spaces, and it's proved very successful in terms of sharing information, especially without, you know, internet being available, even at the height of the COVID crisis last year. And so refugees had to be very dependent, and around 80% of them, as I said, really take what they hear on radio seriously, whereas on WhatsApp there's still issues of fake news and things like that.
Shabnam, as always, great speaking to you. Jazakallah khairan for those updates relating to the Rohingya. Shukran for your time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.